Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today's podcast features Director of Global Macro, Jurrien Timmer. Today, Jurrien reflects on the past year since COVID lockdowns began and notes that despite the eventful year 2020 was, the market did what it is supposed to do, which is discount the future. We saw markets stabilize after an unstable bottom, market leadership expanded, and now the economy looks like it could run hot in the second half of 2021. With host Pamela Ritchie, Jurrien shares his expectations for the future and dives into the growth versus value debate, inflation expectations, and how fiscal and monetary policy may impact markets moving forward. Finally, he'll share his thoughts on the 60-40 portfolio and the topic of investors keeping cash on the sidelines. Jurrien will be sharing a few slides, so head to @TimmerFidelity on Twitter to follow along. This podcast was recorded on March 15th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
That's pretty much 1 year later. Signs of the U.S. recovery and a return to normalcy have begun to emerge. Prospects for the reopening trade certainly are gaining steam as markets look ahead to an accelerated vaccine rollout. But with inflation and real rates rising, what does that mean for the asset allocation and correlation between stocks and bonds? Does the 60-40 still make sense? We're glad to welcome back Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, Jurrien Timmer. Jurrien, great to see you. How are you?
Good morning, Pamela. Nice to see you again. Sorry for not being there last week, but we're back.
We missed you, but you're back now. Let's sort of begin with, if you can, take your mind back to what it was about a year ago. And everyone thought this time is different, as we always do. But was it different, I guess? When we look back at it, what did we know and what didn't we know?
Yeah, you know, as the old saying goes, the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? So in so many ways, this was a unusual, bizarre, once in a million year storm. You know, I mean, it was exactly a year ago we were all told to go home. And I don't think anyone of us thought it would be, we would still be working from home a year later. We figured, you know, okay, a month or two, maybe the summer. But so in so many ways, this was a completely bizarre, different, extreme year. But in other ways, you know, and as a long term market, you know, historian, if you will, or student of the market, it's gratifying to know that the market still did what they kind of tend to do, which is to discount the future and to do a pretty good job at it. So in retrospect, even though we were all questioning whether the markets were, you know, completely disconnected from reality at the time, in reality, actually, the markets pretty much did what they typically do, which is that price will fall a lot, will discount too much bad news, will then find some sort of technical bottom, an oversold bottom. It'll start to stabilize. And then lo and behold, a couple of quarters later, earnings bottom. And at that point, the leadership expands. And that, and now we're at that point where the economy actually looks like it could well run hot for a while in the second half of the year, because we now have in the U.S. 100 million vaccine shots administered in a span of, you know, 2 months.
To follow along here, take a look at Jurrien's slide, COVID-19 cases and vaccines, tweeted March 15th in the afternoon.
And the number of hospital beds, actually percentage of hospital beds in the U.S. has gone, occupied by COVID patients has gone from 19% to 6%. So the COVID curve is really improving. I mean, certainly more so in the U.S. than in Europe. You know, just talking to my relatives, there's some frustration there that things are not happening fast enough over there. But in the U.S., certainly they're happening. And now we have the $1.9 trillion of fiscal stimulus on its way. We have inventories depleted, supply chains disrupted, it all spells an economy that's going to run hot and going to produce some inflation. And this is, of course, what's driving bond yields higher. It's so not only on the inflation side, but on the real rate side. It's what's also taking that rotation from growth to value into overdrive. So the markets, they know, right? And the markets are telling us what's going to happen.
The markets know, and I we don't have to spend too long on it, but you've been sort of taking us through these charts this entire time. And again, when it sort of feels like you're catching falling knives and you don't know, just a comment from you on the comfort of tradition and looking back at history, which has, as you say, kind of borne out.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds maybe a little corny and maybe a little bit too zen, but this notion of trusting the process, especially when you know you can't control the outcome. That applies to life, but it also applies to markets, right? And so I've been a student of market history for 35 years, and I'm still kind of amazed about how well that can work. Because again, economists or analysts who are more fundamentally focused, and I look at the fundamentals, obviously, but 11 months ago or 12 months ago when the market was bottoming, that kind of analysis didn't really get you to where you needed to go, because a lot of people that were waiting for the fundamentals to improve were waiting way longer than they should have in terms of the market responding. But, I was looking at the guts, at the plumbing of the markets, and exactly a year ago, the market reached its third most oversold or second most oversold technical position since the Great Depression, more oversold than 2008. I think 80, I'm just trying to recall here, but I think 86% of stocks in the S&P hit a new 52-week low in that third week of March. And even if that was in an ongoing bear market, the forward returns over 3, 6, even 12 months were just stunningly positive after you see that kind of signal. And that turned out to be the bottom. So I think it's a good reminder to, obviously, we need to be involved in the fundamentals. We need to understand what's going on, monetary policy, economics. But the technical side tells you a lot. And so I would never want to look at only one side and not the other, because you're going to miss out if you do that.
Well, let's dig into one of the other sides and go straight to the policy response, but really sort of the economics that the policy response is trying to shoehorn a little bit here right now. Unemployment is improving. There are signs. They've got CPI that's not moving too quickly, but lots of expectations of inflation obviously around. What do we need to know about sort of pieces of the economy? Let's go to unemployment first, to sort of know what comes next, or what we should be expecting in terms of moves.
I think this is really the critical thing to understand, not only for monetary policy, but fiscal policy as well.
This slide is fiscal and monetary policy, tweeted on March 18th.
So I think that the Fed normally has a dual mandate, right? So 2% inflation, full employment. They have not met their inflation target in over a decade since the Great Recession. And right now, if you look at what's happened in the U.S. over the past year, in terms of the social justice side of things, I think there's a sense both on the Treasury and on the Fed side that policy should be run, the way I like to say it, through an ESG type filter or a DEI type filter, where they want to bring everyone in, not just the people that are more able to survive, economically a pandemic. And so I, in a way, the Fed, I think, has gone to a single mandate, which is full employment, and not just full employment the way it's generally defined, which is what we call the U3 unemployment rate, which is a very narrow definition, but the broader definition of unemployment, which is the U6 unemployment rate, which includes disenfranchised people who are working part-time but who would like to work full-time. So a lot of the people on the edges. And so when you look at this chart here, it shows the spread between the unemployment rate, or a number of different versions of the unemployment rate, relative to what is considered full employment, so the natural rate of unemployment. So that's the unemployment rate that would exist in an economy that is at full capacity, because there's always people moving around jobs or not working, but they're able to, you know, things like that. So you have the U6 here, which is the top, that red line, all the way down to the U3 with college graduates, and you have, you know, minorities in there. And so the punchline is that even though the spread of the U3 over the natural rate is only 1.7, down from 10 percentage points, so that's a very big improvement, the U6 spread is still at 6.6 percentage points over what will be considered full employment. So it's a stunning number, and it's only modestly better than the depths of the Great Recession 12 years ago. And so I think that's the thing we need to look at, and it's the thing that will, I think, help us understand why the Fed is going to be in no hurry to take the punch bowl away. And that's why the Fed is fighting this talk in terms of the yields rising, talks of a taper tantrum. The Fed is saying we're not going to taper asset purchases anytime soon. In fact, they may go even bigger, the way the Royal Bank of Australia, the Central Bank of Australia already has done, in order to fight the yield rise. And, you know, the first rate hike is not really expected until 2025 or 2026.
And this here is the Fed versus the market, tweeted the morning of March 16th.
So the Fed is going to be very, very accommodative here, and it's going to try to, I think, keep yields under 2%, which I think it probably will be able to do. But that's really the challenge that the Fed has, because the Fed needs to persuade or convince the bond vigilantes to go back home. Because the Fed is solving for that unemployment rate, as is the Treasury. And that means that policy is going to be very loose, just like it was in the 1940s, even if inflation starts to come up. And in fact, rising inflation, I would argue, is what the policymakers want and need, because that's what you need when your debt levels are too high. So as investors, do we want to fight against that, or do we want to position our portfolios to be in line with what policymakers want, which is a strong economy and potentially rising inflation? And that's where this whole 60-40 paradigm that you alluded to comes into play.
Okay, and let's certainly go to that. But if you don't mind, just that idea of focusing on getting the economy where it needs to go. I mean, bring the value story into that. It's sort of a rising of all boats, and clearly value is one of the pieces of that story going forward. Let's dip in there.
So again, the markets are signaling exactly what we just discussed, right? So a booming economy, a rotation from growth to value. So growth stocks, so the secular growers, think of the FANGs, if you will, those have been running the show for, you know, 11, 12 years now, right? Since 2008, it's been U.S. large cap growth at the expense of everything else. And a slow economy is part of that. Low interest rates is part of that, because these stocks, they are long duration stocks, right? So the whole notion of these big growers is that they're gonna grow their earnings for a much longer time frame than maybe a value stock will. And when you have a high PE long duration stock, they are very sensitive to changes in the interest rate. And when rates are low, in a way, it's kind of like bond convexity bleeding into the stock market. When you punch like a 1% yield into a discounted cash flow model for these long duration, high PE stocks, it's a totally different story than if you plug in a 2% interest rate. It affects the multiple in a big way. So this is why, as rates are now rising, growth stocks are coming under pressure, but they should be anyway, because as the economy fully reopens, hopefully finally for real now, it should be about value, it should be about small caps, it should be about commodities, it should be about non-US, and it should be about rising yields. The Russell 2000 value is now comfortably taken over from the Russell 1000 growth. Again, it's a scenario that very few people really envisioned 6 months ago.
So one investor writing in saying, you know, Urien, you just mentioned markets obviously discounted the bad news too much at the beginning of a pandemic, sort of the normal market reaction. Are markets now discounting too much good news on the recovery hopes? So are things undervalued?
It's a great question. I don't think they're discounting too much good news, because, but they are discounting the good news. So it's not like there is a positive surprise lurking because something is about to happen that has not been discounted by the market. So we have the fiscal stimulus, $1.9 trillion. We have a Fed who's being very clear about its intentions. And we know that inventories are low and that there's a lot of pent-up demand from U.S. consumers. You know, they have the ability and the willingness to spend money when they can. And so I think that has all been correctly and accurately discounted, and the rise in yields is doing the same thing. So I don't think, but I think where there is still uncertainty is, like, we know inflation's going to come. I mean, it kind of has to. Mathematically, it's like a sure thing, if you will. The question is whether it will just be cyclical and transitory from a low base effect and depleted inventories. And once that corrects itself and people have spent their money and they go back to work and they have to actually go pay their mortgage and go to the office and not have all this time to do other things, that will normalize. But the big question, I think, that I have and that I'm discussing with my colleagues a lot is, will the Fed stay easy for so long that what otherwise would be cyclical transitory inflation effects become entrenched, right? And I think that is really a big question. So the growth to value rotation, is that a 6 to 12 month thing that then runs its course and then everything kind of goes back to normal? Or will this actually become a structural force like it did in the 60s? And we don't really know the answer yet. I can tell you that the charts I have, and we've looked at many of them together, kind of suggest that it might become more structural. But again, that's just a guess at this point. So I think that's where kind of the optionality of taking a stand that's not necessarily discounted by the markets could play out.
So there's a number of questions that have sort of touched on that, and you pretty much answered. So do you think inflation may exceed the Fed target of 2%? You sort of laid out the case there to an extent of when this might take place. Again, it's a big question, and you'll come back to it each week when we go through this. Is there anything to add there? I mean, I feel like you sort of answered that, but that's a specific question.
No, I think, again, how sticky – So the Fed, I think, per the 1940s analog that we've discussed at length in the past, I think the Fed is trying to engineer negative real rates. And because when your debt level is rising and you have a big unemployment gap, you want to stimulate the economy, and negative real rates is ultimately the best way to do it. For that, the Fed needs inflation, because if rates are already at zero, you can't have negative rates unless inflation goes up, which is what happened in the 40s. But then, the question is, let's say they are successful at doing that. Inflation, like bankruptcy, happens slowly and then all at once, right? So you can get to a point where all of a sudden expectations become entrenched, people change their behavior, and then all of a sudden the Fed's trying to put the genie back in the bottle. Again, there's a lot of ifs there, and again, we have pretty powerful deflationary forces in the economy per the demographic story. But I think that is something that nobody knows the answer to yet. When yields were rising until a few weeks ago, they were rising mostly because inflation expectations were rising. And I think the markets were okay with that. The Fed is okay with that, because that means that rates are rising for the right reason. But then a few weeks ago, real rates started to rise. And that is not okay. And this is why all of a sudden you saw kind of some churning in the markets, and all of a sudden the NASDAQ is way down. And that is something the Fed is not so comfortable with. I mean, they understand that a stronger economy warrants a higher real rate than a weaker economy. So I think they're okay with part of it. But again, if they're solving for a negative real rate, you don't want real rates going up. You want them to go down. And so I think that becomes a problem then for the market. So far, the rise in real rates, maybe it's 50, 60 basis points. It's nothing like what we saw in 2013 during the taper tantrum. That saw a 150 basis points increase in real rates in 6 weeks. So that was kind of a shock to the system. It was mostly a shock to the bond market, less to the stock market, but that's because in 2013, the stock market was much less dominated by growth stocks than it is today. So that's why a 50 basis point rise in real rates, you could wonder, like, why would the stock market even care? Like, it's just, that's not really significant. But because the growth domination in the market is so, has been so one-sided, that a 50 basis points change in the real rate really affects the PE of those stocks, and therefore it affects the entire market.
And it's, again, it's something that we'll keep coming back to. There's some really, you have an incredible audience here, Yuri, and there's some extraordinary questions coming in. So let's get to as many of these as we can. One of them is, many governments are messaging the Great Reset, sort of to follow out of the pandemic all across the world. You hear about this. How do you see this government perspective affecting markets? Like, what is the main reset that you see that, you know, we should know about and invest towards?
Yeah, so we have a policy, I don't want to call it coordination, because I can't tell you for sure that Jay Powell and Janet Yellen are meeting in a secret back room every day coordinating policy, but I think they're cut from the same cloth, and they are, you know, we're in that point of history where I do think the fiscal and monetary policy sides are closely aligned. And again, that brings me back to the 1940s, right? That was a period of a big increase in debt. It required some policy coordination. I mean, that obviously was World War II. So at wartime, that's typically what happens. The debt goes up. It gets monetized by the central bank and maybe also through financial repression in terms of interest rates. I think we're seeing all of that now, and I think we're going to continue to see for some time. And I don't have the slide in here today. I'll make sure to put it in for next week, because I have this cool slide that goes back to 1800 that shows, and especially for the Canadian audience who are all gold bugs, I think, it shows you that when the money supply grows much faster than trend, as it did during the 1930s and 40s, it did in the 1970s, and it's doing so now. When you have that period in place and you assume that that growth is going to continue for some time, which I think it will, because the debt stock's not going away anytime soon. And as I said, the unemployment gap is still pretty large. So if that continues, typically what happens is that the value of all of the above ground gold relative to the money supply basically doubles. And we haven't seen anything like that yet. We're seeing it to some degree if you add Bitcoin to the mix, because Bitcoin is, I think it's digital gold and it's kind of eating gold's lunch right now. But if that continues and the value of gold and Bitcoin relative to M2 money supply goes to the extremes we've seen at past periods of monetary inflation, gold could be at 4,000 in 5 years. So, you know, there's some big things going on that we rarely ever see. And so this pandemic kind of unleashed that kind of MMT light a regime, if you will. And if that continues, which I suspect it will, there are still a lot of changes that can take place. And that includes the stocks to bond correlation and ongoing growth to value rotation.
Okay, I want to kind of end with the 60-40 because it sort of ties it all together, everything you've been saying. Great questions here. So one on China and then another about cash on the sidelines. Let's go quickly to China. It's such a massive topic, but thoughts on when China may well be considered the dominant country in global equity markets?
Well, I think it was on its way there a few years ago. Because China would go through these periods of infrastructure investment, and that would like eat up all the resources, all the natural resources all over the world, and all the boom periods and bust periods in the global economy were kind of driven by China's industrialization, right? But now China is kind of, you know, they've reined in on a lot of that. You know, there's only so many buildings and airports you can build. And so China is becoming now more of a consumer-driven economy, more of a new economy. You know, you think of Alibaba and Tencent and those companies. And it's really now the U.S. with, you know, the Biden administration and $5+ trillion of fiscal, and then possibly another $4 trillion of infrastructure coming even this year. So the U.S. is kind of replacing China as the marginal engine of growth. as China becomes more of a mature economy. So I'm bullish on emerging markets. As you know, emerging markets are leading the charge on earnings recovery. But I think it's really a U.S. story right now in terms of policy. And then on the flows real quick, U.S. flows since the pandemic started have now finally crossed over bond flows, which is a far cry from the kind of the speculative extremes that people think it is when they think about GameStop and Robinhood and Reddit and stuff. So the U.S., I don't see that mountain of cash is still there. It's less than it was a year ago, but it's still there. So I think that story is still kind of underreported.
And some of the questions within that are specifically about corporations with cash on the sidelines. But you know what? I'm so sorry. I want to ask you about the 60-40. And then also people want to know about Bruno, the backdrop of Bruno, who's sitting there again because you're back at home. So let's go to 60-40 first, and then he can have his final word.
So this really is a big question right now, right? So if inflation goes from cyclical to structural, big if, I'm not ready to pound the table on that, but if that were to happen, then the stocks to bond correlation, the 60-40, would get upended.
This slide here is stocks bonds correlation, tweeted March 16th in the afternoon, which will be followed by the next tweet, stocks bonds correlation now versus 1960s.
And so just a little history lesson. This chart goes back about 90 years or so. This is the five-year running correlation between the S&P and the long-term government bond real return. And you can see that the regime that we've been in right now, that we're in right now, where bonds are negatively correlated to stocks, meaning stocks go down, you get diversified by being in bonds. That's been in place for the past 20 years, 22 years. Before then, we had, basically a 50-year period where the correlation was the other direction. So rising yields were bad for stocks, falling yields were good for stocks. Right now, the correlation is about minus 30. That's half of where it was in 2015. The last time we saw kind of that potential signal change was in 1960. And if we go to the next slide, so the 1960s have a lot of interesting parallels. We were halfway through a secular bull market, which you can see in the top panel there. We had guns and butter, a lot of fiscal spending. We had a lot of speculation in tech stocks back in the late 60s. We had social unrest in 68. So there are more than a few parallels, but you can see the running correlation in the bottom is kind of following that path. So 1960s when the correlation bottomed, 1964 is where it flipped positive. We're not there right now. We're still comfortably negative, but it's becoming less negative. And if we go to the next slide, what you can see is that the impetus for that switch was, of course, what you would think it is, which is rising inflation. So this is the five-year CPI CAGR in the bottom panel. And we're at that point where inflation back then in 64, 65 started to tick up to levels that the market would take notice of. Because back then, remember, in the 50s and early 60s, the stock market was kind of, it was in a bull market, in a secular bull market, but investors were kind of more income oriented. They were focused on dividend growth. And then in the second half of the 60s, they were worried about inflation and they went into the growthier side. And so we're kind of in the opposite, because right now value is considered more of an inflation hedge than growth. But it was a different world back then. But again, this is a structural relationship that I'm watching very closely, because if we had a change in the signal of 60-40 correlation, it means a lot of different things for us as investors, especially not so much in what you do on the 60 side, because that's a proven inflation hedge that also compounds, but on the 40 side, if the Fed engineers negative real rates, I would want to take some of my money out of bonds and put it in gold and Bitcoin and tips and things like that, which I've already done, because the opportunity cost on the bond side is so low at such low rates. But there are a lot of different iterations of how to think about that kind of secular regime if we end up going there.
Fantastic. We've got a couple of people on over the next couple of days. We'll put some of Yuri and Timur's thoughts to them and ask for more specifics. Okay, Bruno's back, or maybe you're back with Bruno. Just tell us who he is.
We like here the whole time. I just said, so Bruno is a stuffed toy that I gave to my daughter many, many years ago. And a year ago, she's an ICU nurse in Boston, one of the big hospitals. So a year ago, she was obviously on the front lines, not even barely a year out of college. So think about that as your first year of work experience. So I would put Bruno back there. You remember, we were Zooming 24/7 back then. We're still Zooming a lot now, but a little bit less than then. And so I would just put him there as a way to remind everyone that there are people out there basically risking their lives for this thing.
Well, continued good health to your whole family, your daughter, and thank her for her everything that she's doing. And we look forward to speaking to you next week. Thank you so much, Urian Timmer. Awesome.
Thank you.
Urian Timmer joining us today from Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you again.